Good morning. How's everyone doing? Good. Like Heather said, my name is Carter, and I'm one of the pastors here. And just a bit about what I do. So I work on our share team is what we call it. And so we cover local, global, and refugee sponsorship. And so I get to oversee the local side of things that we do here at FAC. So when you hear about like local day camps that are happening besides the Discoveryland ones, that's a whole different beast that I'm not qualified to even be a part of because of what happens there. I can't believe they do that stuff. It's incredible. But in terms of like the soccer camps and the forest lawn camps and all that stuff, that's what I get to be a part of. So just a little bit about me. This morning, we're continuing on with our series, Every Square Inch. And last week, we got to hear from Bill Finnemore, who is our liaison to the church in Poland with the crisis happening in Ukraine. And he was talking about the holistic gospel. And so, yes, we want to provide for those basic needs. But at the core of it, there's a spiritual need that everyone has, and that's to know who Jesus is. And so Bill shared that with us, and about the hope that we have in Jesus, and that hope is actually a person, and that person is Jesus. But today, we're going to narrow our focus a bit here, and we're going to focus on what it means to being actively engaged on the mission of God in the city of Calgary, or if you're joining us online, wherever it is that you are living. Now, I know that when a lot of you think about maybe local outreach, you think about maybe going to different parts of the city that may be maybe more on the low-income side. So you may think of Forest Lawn, maybe the upper southeast or even the northeast. That's what we think about local outreach, of going to serve the poor and the marginalized. And yes, we should be doing those things, and we are doing those things. But I actually think that God actually says a lot more about serving locally in Scripture. And that's what we're going to look at today. So as we begin, I'm just going to lay some groundwork. So if you have a Bible, you can turn to the book of Jeremiah. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 29. If you're unfamiliar with the Bible, it's going to be pretty close to the middle. If you hit a book called Psalms, you got to go a bit further. And if you hit any of the books called Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, you went too far, so you got to back up. And if you're using one of our Bibles that's in the seat backs in front of you, it's on page 557. So I'll give you a quick context for the book of Jeremiah. So the book was written around 600 BC, and it's a compilation of messages that Jeremiah, the prophet, during this time sent to the people of Judah, in which he was pretty much saying, like, you've messed up big time, and the nation of Babylon, who's this powerhouse, is going to come capture you, pretty much destroy you, so you got to just accept it and start asking for forgiveness now. So probably not the best, I guess, kind of Christmas card you're looking for at this time. And at this point in history, like I said, Babylon was this powerhouse, so no one stood in their way. So even if Judah wanted to try and like stand up for themselves, there's no way it was going to happen because Babylon was just an absolute beast. And Jeremiah is actually known as the weeping prophet because we look back throughout the other letters that he sent in the book of Jeremiah, we see a lot of it is doom and gloom, like you screwed up, like it's all over pretty much. And so people were pretty annoyed with Jeremiah. Does anyone else have anyone in their life who's like a constant pessimist? Anyone? No? No one's brave enough to raise their hand? Are they sitting right next to you? Is that why? That's okay. And at some point, you just tend to tune them out, right? Like if someone's always being like, oh, woe is me, the sky's falling. It's like, well, I'm kind of sick of listening to you. So sometimes you just tune them out. So we fast forward and Jeremiah's prophecy is fulfilled. And Jeremiah lives to see the nation of Babylon come and destroy Judah and slaughter a lot of the people who were there. And the ones who weren't slaughtered, they were taken away into exile into the nation of Babylon, except for a few of the poor that were left there to tend fields because Babylon knew they wouldn't revolt or anything. So they left them there to care for the food. So they actually had a food source still. And so chapter 29 comes to a point where Judah has been in exile. And Jeremiah writes to the remaining leaders, so in other words, the ones who were not killed, with a message of hope, but perhaps action in a way that they weren't expecting. So Jeremiah 29, starting at verse 1. So it says, Jeremiah wrote a letter from Jerusalem to the elders, priests, prophets, and all the people who had been exiled to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This was after King Jehoiakim, the queen mother, the court officials, the other officials of Judah, and all the craftsmen and artisans had been deported from Jerusalem. So in other words, anyone who's anyone is gone, so there's no leadership left in Jerusalem. His letter, he sent the letter with Elsa, son of Shaphan, and Gemariah, son of Hilkiah, when they went to Babylon as King Zedekiah's ambassadors to Nebuchadnezzar. So someone still liked Jeremiah because they took the letter for him, so that's nice. And this is what Jeremiah's letter said. It said, "This is what the Lord of heaven armies, the God of Israel, says to all the captives he has exiled to Babylon from Jerusalem. Build homes, plan to stay, plant gardens, and eat the food they produce. Marry and have children. Then find spouses for them so that you may have many grandchildren. Multiply, do not dwindle away, and work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I have sent you into exile. Praise the Lord for it, for its welfare will determine your welfare." So Jeremiah is writing to a people who had just been taken from their homes, had a lot of their friends and family murdered. And so they're likely thinking, I don't want to stay here a long time. Like, if possible, if we can try and like escape and get out of here, or their thought would probably be is they've accepted their fate and that they're going to die there. But instead of allowing the Israelites to just kind of wallow in that misery, God sends a message of hope. He says, build houses, plan to stay. In other words, buckle up because you're going to be here a while. And if actually we go back a couple chapters to chapter 25, there's another prophecy where it says they will be in exile for 70 years. So we actually have a timeline. Set up your lives, planting and harvesting food. Find spouses, establish yourself, grow your family, grow your descendants, and multiply. Do not give in to those pessimistic thoughts that may be clouding your mind at this moment. And I think that last part there, that verse 7, that last part would have been the hardest to comprehend. It says to work for the peace, or the Hebrew word here is shalom, which actually means to be made complete or to restore. So work for the peace and the prosperity of Babylon where God has sent them into exile. So they were not meant to live and they're not meant to be passive or to live separately from the nation of Babylon. They're actually meant to work for or to actively engage in the prosperity of this nation. They were meant to actually seek out ways to build up, to strengthen, build new homes, plant gardens, marry, multiply, and to engage with people around them. And the Lord ends this message to really to solidify what he's saying to this group of people, where he says, your welfare is determined by the welfare of this nation. So in other words, if you want to come out of this alive, if you want to grow, if you want to multiply, you will actually help Babylon in its welfare. You will help it prosper. Have you ever been in a place or people that you just can't really stand to be around? Anyone? A couple weeks ago, I was in Edmonton. I don't know what it is. I just can't wait to leave when I go there. But did you know that we actually have people who are part of our church family who've experienced exile? That we've had people who've had to flee their country because it was unsafe? You know, we have people here who long for the day where they want to go back to their home, where they were born, where they grew up, where their family was. We constantly have people flooding from Ukraine, from Afghanistan, escaping the Taliban, seeking safety, not wanting to leave, but they actually had to. And as a church, we are actually active in welcoming the newcomer in Canada. So just to give you a quick background as another part of our share department. So I mentioned refugees. So FAC is actually considered a sponsorship agreement holder. And so what that means is that we are authorized by the federal government to bring in a certain number of refugees to Canada. And then we also have volunteers. Some of you may be in this room who have actually spent their own money to bring refugees over to Canada. Because if you're a part of this, you actually need to help like supply funds for their first year living here. We also have volunteers who are part of a settlement team where when refugees come, they take them to doctor's appointments, get driver's license, all other types of things they need to do around the city, but they can't because they have no access to transportation or anything like that. They don't know how our bus system or our C train works. But most importantly, they welcome them into their home for a meal. Do you know that the majority of international students who actually come to learn in Canada will never step foot in the home of someone who's born in Canada? I think that's staggering to me. And at a deeper level, for those of us in here who believe in Jesus, we too are actually experiencing exile. Not to the extent that some of our church family is where they physically had to flee, but at the point of creation, we go back to the beginning of when God created the earth. Our purpose was to actually dwell in the presence of God. And then Adam and Eve, the first humans, screwed that up for us and had that separation from God. But there's something within us that is always longing to be back in the presence of God, where we originally intended to be. We long for that day where we get to return home. But while we are here in this place, God says, set up shop, prosper, multiply, and thrive. Pursue wholeness for the place that I have positioned you. Care for the needs, serve the poor and marginalized, and go beyond yourself to serve others. That's the charge for us. So what is it that God's calling us to? Now you may think, okay, Carter, he's the local guy, so now he always needs volunteers, so he's gonna ask me to come and volunteer with him. And yes, that would be awesome. I do need volunteers all the time, but no. Now I could tell you about all the different things we're doing. I could tell you about all the ways we supply food for different communities around the city in Applewood and Forest Lawn, but I won't. I could tell you about the ways that we've supplied funds for schools so they can buy supplies for kids that don't have any, or how we do free oil changes for low-income people or single moms. I won't tell you about that stuff. I could tell you about how we have taken furniture that's been donated and brought them directly to families who have nothing, or about how we're partnering with different organizations around the city who help people who are addicted or abused or homeless. I could tell you about all that stuff. And those things are really great things. And I could share a lot of stories about relationships that have been built and trust that's been formed. But I think there's actually a greater message that needs to be spoken here today, and one that will actually prove more costly to us. And that's one word. It's hospitality. Now, I'm not talking about like the Martha Stewart type of hospitality. Does anyone have like the House and Home stuff where you like you see the front cover and you're like, oh, that's perfect. That house looks amazing. That food looks good. I bet you that food's fake though. There's no way that's real. No, the hospitality that I'm talking about is bring people into your home no matter the state of your house. I'm talking about being ready and welcoming, serving with all the love of your whole entire being. My wife and I have started to call it toast ministry because even if we don't have food on hand, we usually have bread, and so we can always offer someone at least a piece of toast. Like that's like the kind of basic level I'm talking about is I may not have much to share, but I want you to come in and experience what I have. It's that kind of hospitality. Rosaria Butterfield wrote a book called The Gospel Comes with a House Key, in which she used the term radically ordinary hospitality. Such a great term. And she describes it as this. She says, those who live it see strangers as neighbors and neighbors as family of God. She goes on to say, those who live out radically ordinary hospitality see their homes not as theirs, but as God's gift to use for the furtherance of his kingdom. They open doors. They seek out the underprivileged. They know that the gospel comes with a house key. Every time I read this book by Rosaria Butterfield, I get really convicted. And now, since we started this series, it brings me back to the quote that we have at the start of the video, that Kemper quote. I'm going to butcher it, but I'll try. Where he says, there is not one square inch within this whole earth's domain where Christ, who is sovereign, does not cry, mine. That includes our homes. Christ cries, mine. And here in the West, we seem to really love our privacy. I know I do. I'm introverted, so I really love my privacy. I like being able to not be bothered and like being quiet. And even the way that homes have been built has actually drastically changed over the last number of decades. You know, originally it was a front porch where you'd go and you'd spend time. You'd see people walking by. You'd have coffee out there. You'd make conversation. The living room was actually in the front of the house. In older homes around Calgary, you may see this. And the center of the inside of the house was centered around the coffee table or the dining room table. It was centered on conversation. Now, when we look at houses, we often see the deck has moved to the backyard. It's more private. Even living rooms have been moved to the back of the house. When you look inside, you may not even know that anyone's home. And now the center of our home is, everything's pointed towards the entertainment unit. Our home has gone from a place of open doors, being inviting and welcoming, engaging in conversation, to a place of retreat, a place where no one bothers you. So what if, we change the way we view our homes from our fortress of solitude to a place that we actually do not consider our own, but instead a tool to be used in the hands of God to share with others. I know this can be a major shift for us here, and maybe for some of us it's not. Like I know we have quite a few people in our church family who are from South America, and that's just kind of ingrained in our culture, where it's just warm climate cultures. They love relationship. They love to be involved. And maybe that could be some people who grew up in Canada. That's just the way you grew up. You know, my wife is from a small town, so everyone knew everyone. She's extroverted. She loves conversations. So this is actually a lot easier for her. For me, this is really hard for me. Like I said, I'm introverted, grew up here in Calgary, and I love my privacy. I really do. Like when I get home, I'm just like, shut the window, shut the doors. No one's coming in. This is my place. Don't bother me. So it's been a radical shift for me as my wife and I have been walking this journey for the past couple years. And I think that this is a trap that we can get sucked into pretty easily. And that trap is that these are things that we have earned or that we deserve. I think that's a lie that the enemy tries to convince us of, that this is mine, I keep it for myself. When we look at the life of Jesus, and that's actually not how he calls us to live. In one letter, Peter, one of the disciples, he wrote this. He said, cheerfully share your home with those who need a meal or a place to stay. So in other words, we don't do it begrudgingly, but we do this because this is how Jesus acted. He was constantly inviting himself into other people's homes. I mean, that's the funniest part about Jesus. Like, he did that unapologetically. Like, there's so many times he's just like, let me come and have dinner with you. He's like, you guys are rich, so you're going to throw some good food out there. He's like, I'm just wandering around here. Let me come eat. Rosaria Butterfield also stated that hospitality is the ground zero of the Christian faith. Isn't that beautiful? That this is actually where our faith begins, at hospitality. This crucial point where relationships are formed within a home, that intimate setting, this is where the rubber meets the road, where people actually get to see that if the way we talk matches the way we walk in private. So does my actions, do the words I say actually match how I live when no one's watching? A Butterfield again, she says, practicing radically ordinary hospitality is your street credibility with your post-Christian neighbors. It allows you to listen, to keep secrets, to be a safe friend, and to speak a word of grace into dark places. In post-Christian communities, your words can only be as strong as your relationships. Your best weapon is an open door, a set table, a fresh pot of coffee, and a box of Kleenex for the tears that spill. Our words will only go as far as our relationships. We've noticed that actually as we go into places like Forest Lawn and stuff, there, as people come in who don't actually live there, they're actually very like standoffish sometimes. But the more you spend time and the more you actually get to learn about their story, that's when relationships begin to grow. This practice of living life with an open door policy can be really daunting. Another piece of hospitality is that it's actually not just bringing people in. You can still be hospitable by going to someone else's house. Like I said, Jesus did that all the time. Hospitality is not an action. It's not something we do. Hospitality is a heart posture. We must understand that when we live out radically ordinary hospitality, we are actually always both host and guest. That we do not deny help when people are in our home, but we actually ask them to be involved and to engage, because that's, again, how relationships are formed. And as followers of Christ, that when we actually go into other people's homes, we have something much better to bring than just a bottle of wine or having people over for a nice meal. Do you know that as a follower of Jesus, you are his ambassadors, which means you actually have the infilling of the Holy Spirit, the presence of Jesus within your body, which means when you walk through the door of someone's home, you are bringing the power and the presence of Jesus. You are not just bringing some physical or material item. You are bringing the presence of Jesus, which is something far greater than anything else that we could bring. So if we shift from my home is my castle to everyone is welcome, it is not an easy shift. And it takes time. It takes baby steps. Like, I'm not telling you, like, just invite your whole neighborhood over and have them invade your space and all this stuff. Like, we got to do this strategically. There's a book called The Art of Neighboring. It's written by Dave Runyon and Jay Pathak. We actually have a couple copies. Honestly, they're all taken yesterday. You can order them through our bookstore. You can get them there. And they wrote a book on how to actually neighbor well. And they've outlined things of how to do it well. So they take this really through the process of overcoming our fears and not going all in right away, but instead you take baby steps. And that's how we enter into meaningful relationships with those that live around us. And in this book, they actually share a story. So it's based in Denver. So a group of pastors got together with a mayor around the Denver area. And they asked the mayor, they said, hey, how can we actually impact or affect this Denver area? And so the pastors start talking, and they come up with all these things they can do. They say, oh, we can do food hampers, or we can, you know, deliver stuff to schools. And they have this whole laundry list of things they can do, all great things. And they look at the mayor and they say, hey, what do you think about these things? And this is what the mayor said. He said, the majority of the issues that our community is facing would be eliminated or drastically reduced if we could just figure out a way to become a community of great neighbors. The mayor went on to say that relationships are more effective than government programs because they are organic and ongoing. So the pastors looked at each other and they're like, shoot, this mayor just asked us to obey Jesus. How funny is that? A group of pastors were just told by a city official, hey, why don't we just obey the second part of the great commandment? Love your neighbor as yourself. So quickly, I'm just going to go through some Old Testament law. I'm just going to do a hard right turn here. Old Testament law. So hundreds of years before Christ, the Israelites were given the law in order to obey God to the best of their ability. And during that time, when a man named Moses was leading the Israelites out of slavery, they came to the Mount Sinai. And at this place is where they were given the Ten Commandments. Most of you, or some of you, may know what the Ten Commandments are. Okay, and then as we continue to read through the first five books of the Bible, which is called the Torah, or also translated to the Law, the first five books of the Bible, they are actually given not just Ten Commandments, but 613 laws to follow. Try and keep track of that. And then you fast forward a couple hundred years, okay? So Jesus comes on the scene. At this point, he's been teaching and doing miracles and doing all this stuff. And the religious leaders of his day were getting super annoyed with him because people were starting to gravitate towards Jesus and kind of ignoring what they were doing now. And so one of the religious leaders, he's like, okay, let me see if I can get him with this one. So in Matthew 22, it says, one of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. He said, teacher, talking to Jesus, says, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment. And the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commands. So Jesus takes the first 613 laws and he says, these are irrelevant if you don't do these two things. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. I think this is a place that we can also get caught in. I know I get caught in this a lot. We get caught in the place where we say, hey, like I read my Bible, I go to church, I tithe, I serve sometimes, all great things. But without a personal relationship with Jesus and without loving people around us, we can become just as legalistic as the religious teachers of Jesus' day. Without those two heart postures, that's the posture that we can take, legalism. So because this is my job, being out in the community, you know, helping meet the practical needs of people in our city, I've seen a lot of things. I've seen a lot of really tough stuff. You know, I've seen places where we have brought stuff to families who literally had nothing. Like they had four walls of a house, but nothing inside. And we brought everything else that set up their house pretty much. I've seen and been a part of helping a mother and her children escape an abuse situation. We've moved them out of their home. We've supported communities who are facing food insecurities because that is still ongoing. Even though we feel like COVID may be done, there is still food insecurities that are happening. And then there's been places where I've walked through the front door and it's felt like I've walked just through a wall of spiritual darkness. Like it was thick, it was palpable in the air. And all I wanted to do is turn and run, if I'm being honest. Because it felt like fear in this place. So we as a church will never stop being out in the community. We'll never stop going to these places that are quote unquote difficult. If you meet the people there, you actually wouldn't realize that the tough areas because they're amazing people. But we will never stop going to those places because we feel like that's the charge that God's given us as a church. But if someone came and asked me how they could serve the city, they say, Carter, I don't have a lot of time. I got some, but I don't have a lot of time. What can I do? This is what I would say to them. I would say, get to know your neighbors well and love them. That takes commute time out of things. Take that time that you would have gone to different areas of the city and spend it having a conversation with the people who live around you. Take that time and get to know the people, establish relationship, create a culture on your street where people engage with one another. And if you have more time, then please come back to me because I have lots of other things that I could have you do. That'd be awesome. But this is the reality of our church. We are represented in every single quadrant of the city. Okay, people come here from the northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast. That's just the reality of our church. And I'm pretty sure we're actually represented in every single community of this church as well too. I was looking at our database. I stopped counting because I just couldn't keep track. So if we take that advice of the mayor in Denver where he says all these problems will be eliminated if people just become good neighbors, then I think the times when people come to the church asking for help, those needs would actually be met by our FAC family who lives around them. So maybe you've lived in the same house for a long time, but you actually don't know the people around you. That's okay. That's okay. But start today. Go and knock on some doors. My wife and I, we're the crazy neighbors. We're the ones who go around. As soon as we just moved into Manipur about a year ago, and as soon as like that same week, we went knocking around to different doors saying like, hey, like we're Carter and Sarah, we just moved in. And some people would just like look at us through the curtains and just think we're trying to sell something. Other people would open the door and just be totally weirded out that we just came to say hi. So you'll get a mixed bag, but it's fine. But it's time to make that shift and to actually enter into that awkward conversation with people, being like, hey, I know we've lived here across the street from each other for like 5 years, but I don't know your name. What's your name? It's gonna be awkward, but we gotta lean into that because if not now, then when? The longer we wait, the more awkward it's gonna get. It's time to make a shift in our neighborhoods. Maybe you've just moved into a new place. Like I said, this is a great time to do it. Start going door to door right now. You can say, hey, we're the new ones. We just want to know who you are. We had a block party about a month ago or so. We had 60 people, 60 of our neighbors come out. You realize a couple things. You realize who the partiers are. They're a real good time. You want to make friends with those people. We also realized, so like I said, we live in Manipur, typically older demographic. But we realized there's more young families that live on our street than we knew. And so by engaging with your neighbors, you actually get to figure out who lives around you. And also the neighbors you thought were grumpy, they're actually kind of fun. We figured that out too. So it's fascinating to see what God does with our time when we actually allow ourselves to be interruptible. No, the way that I've actually seen relationships with neighbors grow is actually when I ask them for help. There's a humility to hospitality. It's never I'm coming with all the fixes or all the answers. I've seen the biggest steps in my relationship with my neighbors is when I've asked someone to come and help me, or I've asked someone to actually borrow something. It's fascinating. People are fascinating. So as you walked in today, you should have been given a yellow card. If not, you can grab it on the way out. On the back of it, you'll see a house. So this represents you and where you live. The 8 boxes around this house represent your 8 closest neighbors. And so you can actually find, this is from the book, The Art of Neighboring. And so this is an exercise that you can do as you go home. If you live by yourself or if you do it with your family. So if you live in a house, you pick the 8 closest houses around you. If you live in an apartment, maybe it's the ones across the hall from you. Basement suite, doesn't matter. This is relevant no matter where you live. And so as you're at home, under line A, that's the name of your neighbor. Okay, what is this, their name? Can you get 8 names down of people that live around you? Do you know about only 10% of people can actually fill that one out? Line B, That would be a piece of information that you would need to have a conversation with them to know. So it can't be that you have a red truck or they got three kids because you see them running around or anything like that. You have to actually engage in conversation with them to fill B out. And only 3% of people can usually do that. C, this is a hope, a dream, or a fear. So this requires a deeper level of conversation. And usually only less than 1% of people can fill that out. So just by hearing those numbers, we see that relationships with our neighbors are not that deep. They can be pretty surface level. But this is the mission field that God has placed you in. So in a moment, we're going to be celebrating baptisms with the 10 people in our church family here. This is one of my favorite days of the month when we do these things. And with baptism, this is people saying yes to Jesus. This is them following in obedience to what he's asking them to do. This is not save. This is not salvation, right? This is simply a step in obedience to what God's asking us to do when we follow him. And this is actually what being a follower of Jesus is all about, right? It's about following in obedience to what Jesus is asking us to do. And that's what neighboring is all about. That's what being engaged in our community is all about. You say, God, who are the people, who are the neighbors that you want me to go and talk to? Is it all of them? Is it certain ones? But at the core of being a follower of Jesus, being a disciple of Jesus, it's a long road of obedience, as Eugene Peterson puts it. It's continually asking him, what do you want from me? What do you want for me to do? And then going and doing it. My dream for our church family, this is my dream, is yes, that we'd be active in every area of the city, but my dream is that every single community in which our church is represented, there would be a missional outpost because the people of First Alliance Church have taken it seriously when they said, I want to be actively engaged in the people around me. When I say missional outpost, this is what I mean. I mean, people are drawn to you because they see the light and the love of Jesus shining through your words, shining through your actions, and they just want to come and experience more. That may we be the homes where people come when there are issues, when there is death, when there is divorce, when there is abuse. May we be the people that they come to ask, where do I find healing and wholeness? Because we know exactly where to find it. So Jeremiah says, build homes, plant gardens, marry, and multiply. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city, for its welfare determines your welfare. God has placed you where you are for a reason. You may have picked the house, you may have picked the community, but what I've learned over the last couple of years is that God's plan is way more impressive than my own, and he is thinking light years ahead of me. We are to be active participants in the mission of God as he is in the business of restoring and renewing creation. He wants us to be partnered with him by being his ambassadors to those who live around us. So let's be people who listen to the voice of God and seek the peace and prosperity of the city in which we live and pursue radically ordinary hospitality and be a faithful presence to those who live around us. Let's pray. Father, just thank you for who you are. Thank you that you know what's coming ahead of us. Thank you that your plans are way better than things that we could come up with ourselves. God, you're in the business of restoring people. As we come to this relationship with you and to follow you, you are restoring us, you are renewing us, you are creating us into your image. And so may we help people along that path as well. Father, use us. Mold us, help us to be a faithful presence where we live, and that people would be drawn to us, not because of who we are, but because of who you are, and that you live within us. We thank you for that, Jesus. Amen. We're going to be celebrating baptisms now. So this is what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to stand to your feet if you are able. As people go down into the water, I want you to scream. As they come up out of the water, I want you to clap and scream even louder. Okay, let's celebrate with our church family here.